Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is a second podcast, Wild Ride, and it's a sort of a sequel to the first one where I sort of analyse the space in the world in which David Cohen exists in his Chasing the Sun, and the sort of the theory of relativity is as applied to frameworks. So he has a framework of the landed gentleman who can just go around and observe things, not necessarily having anyone to disagree with him. Then the another framework of the academic framework, which in theory works in a particular way, but in practice works differently. So in theory, it's a very, very eloquent place where things are discussed equally. There's no power structures, and basically you could be a bird which lands on the windowsill of a lecture theatre and chirps something out, and people would not bat an eyelid. But in reality, there's this great, it's just a social structure as anything else. And so there's a real Game of Thrones going on. So between the two, the public is left none the wiser about these phenomena. So in describing the sun, it's got differences from, I suppose, a confusion of the actual sun itself as a star and our variable journey of a star. So it's sort of like a celebrity. You go up and... you can see a celebrity from afar, or you can go to the cocktail party, all these different things. It's the same celebrity, but you see it in different lights, and that's so true to the sun. There's certain times the sun's largely overhead, certain times the days of the year are slightly longer and slightly shorter. Now, incredibly, the days of the year, i.e. as the day is between the zenith of the sun and the next zenith of the sun, that varies, and that takes a bit to understand. And to get into that aspect, we have to discuss the thing of orbits. Unfortunately, I was having to do some fairly boring rehab on a treadmill and stuff like that, so I was able to think about it in a certain way, because indeed there are these lineal progression of ideas, and basically, it's sort of like progression of ideas, memorising a supermarket in terms of what's on what shelf in what order. And when you have a shopping list that you're cooking for dinner tonight, and someone's telling you in detail what's on the shelves and in what order, and this, the function of the cold food, it's too much information. I don't really need to know it. But indeed, you really do need to know this, because when you're trying to get in and actually analyse how people shop or how people interact with the knowledge, you have to see that at certain points in time, people didn't know about certain parts of the shop which were going to evolve, if I'm using that terminology. So what I want to do is, indeed it is a linear progression with some approximations at certain points, some shortcuts at certain points, which have been sort of subsumed into the mainstream. And to see that, you have to get an overall picture to see how a shortcut relates to the major thing and its use and appropriate choice. So it's sort of like you've got a shortcut, you found your way through from point A to point B, and you cut across a field, and you skip over a creek, and you get to the place, the lecture theatre, really soon. Then the bus rolls up, and you say, "Look, I know this great shortcut." Now, what happens is the bus goes along this route, and it's starting knocking over trees, and people are running out of the way, and that's a bit unusual. But it is shorter. It's these shortcuts have got their devils involved in it. So I can think of at least two or three devils sitting in there that people have shortcuts, and they're, incredibly, this shortcut is a shortcut. It doesn't account for things. It's a bizarre new effect. Really, it's just the way things have evolved. So the first process is, I just want to get across, there's, I suppose there's two different things. There's get off my bum. I'm just travelling at normal speed, mate. Sorry, I got a hoot. I think I got a hoot from someone. And this declarative knowledge. Yeah, so you've got the difference between... you've got this uncomfortable feeling, this car going, oh, he's not paying attention to me. I really hate aggressive drivers. So I'm driving, so it's a combination. Look, the important thing to understand is that there are two forms of knowledge. One is declarative knowledge, where you are told something, and you've been told, therefore you know. And there's... constructive knowledge. So declarative knowledge, I can tell you that you are a servant and you don't speak back to me, and I have my breakfast served to me at 8:30 p.m. and my eggs are poached thus. And you have to know that. And do you know this? You can know it by performing this task. So that sort of knowledge is declarative knowledge. I've declared that you are a servant. I've declared this is going ahead, and you can respond by knowing this knowledge, and you can be rewarded for knowing this knowledge. This is slightly different. It's constructive knowledge, to know where the egg comes from, to know something a bit about the aging of eggs. The eggs have to age a certain amount before you can crack them, and certain things, and you can tell the age of it. This is constructive knowledge, where you're getting little bits of information. It's not structured. It's not declared. It's empirical knowledge. And to start off with, we've grown up with declarative at the start, because experiments hadn't exist. It was all declarative knowledge, and when you're in your declaration mode, you declare one thing, and you've got a palette of things, and you're declaring, oh, the sun is like this, I'm in power, you're not, and it's all in the same sheet, so shut up. Now that's occurred. Then we've had a period of constructive knowledge, where people have actually said, oh, well, she was able to build a solar panel, so I can't do that by someone just telling me. I've got to actually work this out. I've got to take measurements and measure the angles and all that type of stuff. But what's become full circle in that we're back to declarative knowledge. So I declare that planets orbit the sun in a circle. I just declare it. And I just teach kids. That's all they can know. And initially, constructive knowledge has to evolve from a system of declarative knowledge. So it's a real art to get that across. It's a real temptation that if you've got someone who's got no constructive knowledge, only declarative knowledge, they can't understand. They don't have the understanding to construct constructive knowledge. So, a lot of us, including David Cohen, are not very much better off, because we've actually got this declarative knowledge. We've declared that it's a circle. Now, let's go back in time, and I'm just going to give you an overarching view. There's God circles. There's circles around the Earth. So God circles around the Earth, circles around the Sun, ellipses around the Sun, magic gravity, mechanical gravity, and theoretical gravity. Okay, so all these ideas, okay, there might be formulas, but they're ideas. There's a shorthand to say, when I see a phenomenon, I don't have to keep on looking at it. That's that phenomenon. I can pull my attention to something else, like serving my master dinner, or being whipped, or having my family ripped away from me and thrown into slavery at my master's whim. I can focus on that. But constructive knowledge is very complicated. So we've got that sequence. And we're going to start off with the magic circles. Indeed, a lot of people go to Pythagoras, but a lot of Pythagoras's theories and ideas are based on Babylonian solar myths. And Pythagoras was really trying to work out the difference between matter and thought, and things that we find hard to understand. And so he did something really profound. He got a stick. Now, we don't know whether he did this with a stick or a slate or something like that. Got a stick, made a single mark in the sand, and then he thought, what's the most perfect thing I can do? I can draw a line equidistant from that point. And he called that the monad. And he was saying, there's something fantastic. You've got to understand, at the time, we're just leaving the Stone Age, we're getting into the Bronze Age and stuff like that. And this is 780 BC, so it's just on the cusp of really ancient history. It's pretty ancient history. And he said, by Jove, the circle is it. It's something like people nowadays saying the internet, fiber optics. He said the circle is it, and it's the monad. Now, the monadism, that is the theory of between matter and knowledge and particles of matter and particles of knowledge, goes right up. You've got Leibniz and people like that. And Leibniz, for instance, said, the purest numbers are zeros and one. I think one represents God and zero represents nothingness, a void. But he actually came up with binary arithmetic. He came up with the digital thoughts. At the time of Newton, he laid down the laws of digital stuff. But this is all decorative stuff. This is religious stuff, if you can allow me a religious belief. These things are religious. So he said, this is Pythagoras, and bear in mind at this stage, you couldn't, the planets and the suns were only specks of light. And he said, because they are holy, and because spheres are holy, they're spherical. It's sort of like your gran picking the winning numbers, and and she dies many years later, and then you use her winning numbers and you get a huge amount of lotto, and you go, oh, how did that happen? And you think, oh, Gran was super special. No, well, it's just that there's actually no logical steps. It was explained in fullness. There's no logical steps for it. That the spherical things are up there is perfect, and circles are perfect, and heaven is perfect, and obviously if I throw something, it tends to sort of go in a sort of line. So I know, well, we've got definite proof that the actual the earth is not heavenly, that's for mortals, but the heavens, things go in circles. So before we knew about orbits, before we knew about anything, we said things go in circles. So the sun circles the earth in a perfect circle. And when I say circle, I mean geometrical circle. This is R equals 1,153,000,000 kilometers exactly. All the time, always, because it's a perfect circle. A non-perfect circle is a heresy. Now, if I can say, this persisted way, 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 way up into late medieval times, and indeed, it's the complexity of dividing the world up between the heavens and the world of the world, this is a sublunar world, spawned so many different things. It actually spawned the origin of our understanding of mass as opposed to matter. All this sort of thing was involved in getting that out. So we've got these perfect circles, and the real circles, God circles, and then circles within circles is what Ptolemy came up with, 300 AD. So this is a good thousand year anniversary of Aristotle. About time we came up with something sophisticated, and he was a humdinger. He said that things go in circles, but they don't go in a circle based on the centre of the circle of the Earth. It goes in a centre above our Earth. So up a very high pole, is the actual axis of rotation of all these planets. And then these planets themselves, just they don't go on their little circles out there, they go on epicircles. So we have an epicenter of a grand circle, and then there's a epicircle. That means extra, I suppose. Epi means extra. So you've got all these sort of amazing things, and this, he was able to slam dunk it, predict the directions of planets, get them to go backwards, retrograde motion. That is when the Earth swings around the Sun at a greater speed. Oh, here we go, car going for Jesus fast. So when the Earth spins around faster, and it sort of overtakes the planet looks as though, say you're driving a car and you speed past it, Gran in her little jalopy. Jan's still going forward, but she looks as though she's slipping backwards. And so the planet's slipping backwards, they're able to do this. Ptolemy, a genius of getting wrong ideas and tweaking them till they worked. And so they had this fantastic idea. And so this really did, if it's good, don't fix it. It's like our belief in the monarchy. You know, like Australia has Queen Elizabeth as the head of, nominal head of state. And we're going, oh, this is wrong. Oh, it works. We're not having war, we're not having pestilence, it works. So, basically, astronomy worked with these perfect circles within circles. So you've got God's circles, circles within circles, and then you've got Copernicus. Now, we can't say, at the time of Copernicus, it was enough to say things orbited around the Sun and not around the Earth in a perfect circle. He wasn't going to go any further than that. Obviously, they have to go in perfect circles. We don't know, because things go in circles in space. Now, you think things go in circles in space. What a stupid, bigoted, revolting way to live your life. Hey, Mum. Hey, Dad. Why do things go in circles? Well, you've heard of God. And God makes things go in circles, and shut up. Now, you might think you're saying that may have been the way they said in 300 AD or something like that. No, that's how they say it in 2020, nowadays. Basically, I have taught my class proper that things orbit in circles. And I've just told them to shut up. The reason that they walk in a circle is that they're attracted together. You might add a little bit more to it, but it's in a circle. And so there was really big news. And next, so I'm just saying that we haven't, although we think we've advanced, the reality is that we have got everyone spread out. Everyone's not on the science bus. People have been getting off at different points in time, forming communities, forming relationships, having absolutely scrambled ideas, and without really knowledge of this complete, in the army you used to call it a cluster, something or other, a cluster. But this is just people going off different pieces of information. This is like, for sure, if this is a military unit, we'd be losing the battle badly, because we're badly led. And the bottom line is that we have got very poor science leadership. And so people can get away with just unbridled arrogance. Where there should be understanding, they've got arrogance. Okay. So the big news was Kepler. And we're going to, get back to Kepler. Kepler is a student of Copernicus. Copernicus was a religious nutter, I have to say so. Kepler was able to work out something a bit more complicated. And this is a squished circle, an unholy circle, an ellipse. And he was able to get his ellipses to work, and we have put it into three laws. Now, only the most stupid people tell you that, oh, because it's a law, he discovered a law. No, a law is just a set of consistent observations which happen in nature. A law is a post-it note for, look at this space, theory is a coming. Theory, there's going to be a coming, a theory here. This is happens all the time. This is ripe for a proper explanation. But no, not at school. People are just taught the laws. Have you learnt the laws, Kepler's laws? That's beautiful. You understand it. So let's go into this Kepler story. I'm going to have to stop here and go negotiation. I hope I can remember. I can't ask you to remind me because you are out in podcast land. It's a podcast, but to I'm going to go in and do Kepler's laws and hopefully do a good job of it, because this is what I'm aiming for, is to actually give more interesting podcasts on a narrow point of views and actually teach something in a podcast. Okay, I'm back again, and hopefully this will be slightly a higher sound quality, as I've got myself a lapel microphone. Oh dear, this person's a bit upset about something. Okay, I'm coming home now. Unfortunately, it's now inched into peak hour traffic, so it'll be a little bit slow coming home. Yeah, so I'm going to wrap up that it was circles, then circles within circles, and then circles not around the Earth, circles around the Sun, and then finally, to get it working, circles around the Sun didn't work. So the circles within circles worked around the Earth. Circles within circles didn't work around the Sun. So you've got a fundamental problem there. And this is eventually solved by Johannes Kepler, who probably didn't have the same formulas. He had sort of lots of tables and drafting and drafted up these ellipses to sort of guess the ellipse. So he's got no story for it. He's just saying that, look, they don't travel in circles, they travel in ellipses, and we've got no idea why. So, and as I said before, he came up, there were four laws. Now, to the untrained person, to the person sort of teaching kids, if you teach the laws of gravity, the laws of Newton, you've taught science. And a lot of people say, oh, I'll teach you the Kepler's three laws. So Kepler's three laws were thus. Now, I'm going to convert the third law so it's a little bit easier to remember. Too many variables up there. His first law is the things go in ellipses. What? Okay, now, if you've got no mechanics behind it, an ellipse, you've just got to accept it that a certain planet goes in ellipses. There's sort of no particular reason for it. His second law is that if you track any satellite or comet or anything which is travelling along ellipse for a period of time, the air is swept out by the line between you and it. Imagine that line as it paints across is equidistant. So let me try and explain that more in terms of pizzas. Now, the reason, I'll explain this afterwards. Imagine that you have an elliptical pizza and you can find the focus of that. So you can define the focus. If you're going to get a elliptical pizza, what you do is you get your dough, put it on a huge flat plate, then you drive two nails in at two differences, and that's going to be the distance of your foci. Then you have a scalpel which is held by a loop of string. So if that's loop's a very large loop compared to it, you'll get a circle. But if it's a tighter loop compared to it, you'll get a reasonably good ellipse. That's how you can draw an ellipse. You can construct an ellipse. Thus, now,
We're not going to tell you how you do it, but you are serving a very vicious family, and they're determined to have the same slice size each. So what you do is you cut your pizza on such that each slice has the same area. Everyone gets the same amount of food. So if you're in the part of the pizza closest to the ellipse, you cut a larger angle. And then if you're further from the ellipse, you know, you can either get a fat, short, wide pizza or a skin long, skinny pizza. And you've got to make sure everyone eats the same. And what that means is that each of those pizzas are equivalent in time for an orbit. So we can imagine this is that when something falls close to a star, it starts to sweep past the star really relatively quickly. Just watching where this comes across. Now, just in a little aside, why do I describe the food stuff? Well, it's an educational theory that we know that if you start talking about food and sizes, people's brains flick onto a much more logic thing. They cut a whole lot of garbage out and they make sure that everyone gets the same slice amount. This is a sort of fundamental programmed thing of man as a social animal, is the focus that everyone gets the same amount of food each time. So that's there. So our two laws so far is the ellipse and the equal pizza slice one. Now, the second one is a little bit more complex to go. Now, it is that the length, if for all satellites going around the same planet, now for Kepler, he only looked at the planets going around Earth, as going around, I say Earth, around the Sun. So he didn't have any other exceptions, no one else had to really work what's going out. He said that the speed is equal to the radius, is proportional to the radius. So the time it takes to go around a track is equal to the radius times the square root of the radius. And so that's a illegitimate Aussie version of it. So, but it's much easier to remember because you've got less things going in your head. You've got less cognitive load to remember it. So let's pick up something. I've got a just nominally, say Venus, which is going on an orbit, and I have Mars going in orbit, and say Mars is four times further out. So the distance, if it's 1 R, one Venus distance, it'll be 2 pi R for Venus, and 2 pi 4 R, the distance will be four times as long, because the distance of an orbit is four. So you expect the four. Now the other thing is that it's also travelling more slowly. So your track distance, your circular distance is proportional to your radius, but you also slow down a set amount due to the distance further out, because you've got less force pulling you in the circle, so you don't have to go as fast to pull away from it in a certain sense. So Mars, which is four times as out, I'm only saying Mars and Venus, I'll explain that a little bit later, is travelling four plus times the square root of four, eight. So Venus will do, one Venus year will be equivalent, well, one Martian year will be equivalent to eight Venus years, okay? Because Venus has got a smaller amount, four times smaller amount to travel, and it's travelling twice as fast. So just remember that the period of an orbit is proportional to the radius, which makes sense because the size, plus another time, a multiplication factor, which is the square root of the radius. Now, there's people do the cube and square and like various things. It's a bit more complicated. Now, these are the three sets of laws. They're called Kepler's laws, and they're taught in school as laws, and they're declarative. You don't get to understand them more deeply. And indeed, it takes a little bit of more maths to understand it more deeply, and that little bit more maths is due to Newton. But now so coming up in terms of that direction, you've got Newton and Einstein and eventually Higgs. The Higgs boson to explain what's going on. Okay, got this under control. So that's in the future off. But let's go here. That when a planet goes closer to the sun, it speeds up. It sweeps more of its pizza fraction out. Now, this has a profound effect. Now, it's going to be counterintuitive that when it's closer to the sun, it sweeps out a greater angle per day. Now, the Earth spins around on its axis. It doesn't take 24 hours to spin. It takes 23 hours and 56 minutes. And then on average, listen to this, on average, it takes a further 4 minutes spinning to track. It's spun further around for the sun, and then it's got 4 more minutes to spin such that the sun is in the viewfinder again. So we've got the sidereal day, which is the day specified by this, by space. That is, I've got a coffee cup in my in front of me, and I spin it around one full rotation. Now, if I move the coffee cup, so I'm moving the coffee cup and it's looking down, it's anti-clockwise, so I'm spinning it. I then move the cup anti-clockwise to the left. I spin it around, I want that handle to face towards me, and I've moved it off to the left. I'm going to have to move it that little bit extra more. Now, this is where it gets a bit complicated. So there's a couple of things here that the length of the solar day varies. Sometimes it's longer than 24 hours, and sometimes it's shorter than 24 hours, but on average it averages out over 365 days to 24 hours. So just get that into your head. This is sort of the most mind-bending thing possible. So it's okay with 23 hours and 56 minutes, and then there's a whole extra day to account for the fact that the Earth's actually orbiting, so that's, you can get that right. But the length of the day is sometimes a bit more than 24 hours, sometimes a bit less than 24 hours. And in fact, it's a little bit more than 24 hours, a little bit greater for a shorter amount of time. That is, it's a little bit more than 24 hours in the time it's sweeping past Earth. Sweeping closer to the sun. As it slows up, it takes longer to do that orbit. But so there's more days there's more cuts at a smaller angle cut of your pizza. That sort of makes sense. You have on average, your angle is actually measured as the number of minutes it takes to rotate. Okay, that's pretty cool. I like it. So the angle that you move in orbit around is proportional to the number of minutes additional that you have to continue to do extra rotation to point yourself back at the sun. And so we've organized it, but this is something we can't tell everyone. So Indeed, people get exhausted, sidereal day, 23 hours and 56 minutes, but the solar day is in the Australian summer, because the Australian summer is actually goes when we're a little bit off. Now, the actual major axis, when we pass the major axis of the ellipse that we're tracking out. So our ellipse is not a big ellipse. Okay, Mercury is a humdinger of ellipse. It's got, Mercury goes from 60 million kilometres to 40 million kilometres. Yes, that's a big ellipse. Whereas Earth goes from 49.7 million kilometres to 152 kilometres. So our Sun expands and shrinks by a couple of cents size each year. Now, this is something that David Cohen hasn't put down. He hasn't actually done the maths, and which is complex enough, and he hasn't actually placed it with different things. So the Egyptians, or the people who only said, look, the Sun's getting bigger and smaller, are after Kepler. They've only when they realised that, they said, well, Kepler, if you're right, the Sun has to be getting bigger and smaller. Oh, you are right. But we haven't gone, oh, it's going bigger and smaller. Can anyone have an explanation of it? So it didn't happen that way. And so it's interesting. And once you get there, you get the difference between a sidereal day and a solar day. And then, because it's an ellipse, the solar day is slightly different. It's slightly, so in our Australian summer, the time between full noons, and it's, when I say, it's actually dead on our summer, in actual fact, the time between two noons, okay, the time between two midday on two successive days in our Australian summer is slightly longer. So we're closer, and it takes a bit longer for us to get the Sun into position. Now, but that thankfully goes for a shorter period, because we sweep out the arc with longer segments more quickly, and then so it might be, say, I don't know, I really don't know, 24 hours and 1 minute is the day, length of the day in Australia. And so what this happens is that 1 minute is that dawn and sunset move a slightly out of kilter. Okay, so but the averages, the length day night ratio is typically only set by the angle, but the position of when dawn is and when sunset is, so the two can come down together and up together. They vary amounts. So I think it will be, you know, fractions of a second. It can't be a minute per day, but it's a thing, and it builds up. And so your sunset and sunrise, so the longest day of the year is not the earliest sunset. What happens is the longest day of the year, the sunrise is still going to be at an earlier time, but what happens is that the sunset starts to also creep at an earlier time at a greater rate. So just get that into your head here. Now, I haven't really said that for the Northern Hemisphere. Now, you can see that if someone can't explain that or doesn't want to explain it, you're in for a massive surprise. Now, the next one to get is the axis of the Earth, which gives you seasons. But the point is that the seasons are relative to our calendar, which is set by the stars. Well, it's hard to say. Look, the next episode I'm going to try and cover the slipping of the zodiac. Now, I don't know, I think the zodiac may have been changed by as much as a month since the time of Christ. And so, fundamentally, the zodiac times are wrong. So the ancient use of the zodiac lines are slipping. Your sign, your times of your zodiac are slipping. And I don't know how many days. I haven't really looked into that. So your zodiac will do a full rotation every 23,000 years. So, so that's in 2,000 years. That's a month, a 12th, I think. Yeah, something like that. And so it's not wrong that the zodiac is so completely screwed. I can't really process it. It's too screwed for me to even worry about. Okay, that's been said, and hopefully the new the new lapel mic squirked, and it will allow me to exercise and talk at the same time. Sorry, guys. Got to finish now. Bye.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.